This is Monday, the 8th of August, 2005, at the Freiburg New Church Assembly. This is the first lecture in this year's session. My name's George Dole. My title is The Patriarchal Family, Text and Subtext. For a number of years now, I've been working away from time to time on a way to introduce both the concept and the substance of the spiritual sense of Scripture by following Swedenborg's advice rather than his example. His advice is to start with general ideas because, and I quote, without a general idea of a subject, we do not understand any of its details. Even more emphatically, and again I quote, as long as general principles are not known, no light can fall on the details of a matter. General notions must come first, for without them the details have no lodging place, close quote. But when it came to presenting the spiritual sense of the word, he started with Genesis 1, verse 1, and proceeded to verse 2 and verse 3, verse by verse, often word by word, detail after detail after detail. Well, what happens if we come at the Bible from the other direction, if we start from general notions? Well, if we step back from the Bible far enough to get an overview of the whole, we find a story that has a very definite shape. It starts with a beautiful creation that declines into a fragmented world, a world with people scattered abroad speaking mutually incomprehensible languages. And this is the setting in which God calls one individual, Abram, with a promise of greatness, and that promise is the mainspring of the rest of the story. That's an oversimplification back to which I may come at some later time. This one individual becomes a family, and then a clan, and then an assemblage of clans. They gain a kind of independence. They're given a legal structure at Sinai. They take possession of a homeland. Under David, they actually achieve a measure of greatness, but within two generations, it starts to come apart, and eventually it's overwhelmed and lies in ruins. But the people retain their sense of identity, and the promise survives. One of the forms in which the promise survives is in the expectation of a descendant of David, an anointed king or Messiah, who will lead the nation back to its former glory. And in the Gospels, we find Jesus identified as this Messiah. But the focus on the kingdom of Israel has shifted and is now a focus on the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God. The crucifixion decisively ends any hope of earthly triumph. The resurrection, the ascension clearly point beyond this world, and in fact, the book of Revelation shifts immediately from the Isle of Patmos to the spiritual world. And the ultimate fulfillment of the promise to Abram is not an earthly but a heavenly city, the New Jerusalem coming down from heaven, coming to earth, but not quite here yet. And this is what I would propose as a general idea in which the details of the Bible can find a lodging place. Because after all, the Bible is a story, and it makes no sense at all just to lift chapters out of the context, out of a narrative context, and pass judgment on them. If you were to pick up a novel and open it in the middle, you wouldn't expect to understand what was going on. And I'd urge that we read with the general notion that at every point in the story, God is reaching out to people wherever they are, and sometimes they are in some pretty grungy places, and trying to turn them in the direction of the holy city. Which means that every passage will tell us something about the Lord and something about ourselves. One way I like to put it is to say that the Bible simply tells us what we have heard God say, and that it testifies both to God's infinite persistence and to our own terribly faulty hearing. I've become particularly intrigued by what I'm coming to think of as a layer of meaning just under the surface of the letter, something like the Lord's hidden historical agenda. Let me give just one example. No, and then I'm going to go back on my word and give some more. 11 times in the Pentateuch, the promised land is described as a land that flows with milk and honey. Yet we read that Abram had barely finished his first traverse of the region before there was a famine in the land. So Abram went to Egypt and prospered there and came back a wealthy man. In the next generation, something quite similar happened. A famine in the land induced Isaac to emigrate to Philistia. He settled there and prospered and came back to Beersheba wealthy. It wasn't famine that drove Jacob out of the land, but it was with his relatives in Aramea that he became rich and eventually returned to the promised land to become reconciled to his brother Esau. And finally, the whole family goes to Egypt and prospers in the land of Goshen, again driven out of the land by famine. And in order to survive, they went to Egypt. Surely a land that flows with milk and honey ought to be able to do a little better by its inhabitants than that. Well, one of the basic principles of Swedenborgian biblical interpretation is that what is mentioned first in a series determines the theme of what follows. For example, see Secrets of Heaven 8864. It probably shouldn't have taken me all these years then to take very seriously the way the patriarchal story begins. It does not begin with the promise to Abram. It begins with a command to Abram, and that command is to leave his family. Leave his land, his kindred, and his father's house. I want to digress a moment for another of these dissonances between the theory and the practice, so to speak, this layer under the surface, this subtext. In the story of the divided kingdom, the theory is that the prosperity and security of the nation depend on its loyalty to the Lord, with a particular emphasis on devotion to the temple in Jerusalem. And every king is evaluated against this standard. Did they allow worship, sacrificial worship, of any other place than the temple in Jerusalem? To the extent that they did, they were bad kings. To the extent that they cut down the groves, threw down the altars, and so on and so forth, they were good. There is simply no predictable correlation between this form of loyalty and the prosperity and security of the nation. And some of the presumably good kings, like Jehu, who was the one who wiped out the worship of Baal, the terrible sin, was a military and economic disaster. And one of the most conspicuously successful ones was Jeroboam II, who is simply dismissed as one of the evil ones. Now, I have no doubt that these dissonances are spiritually significant. I mention them here simply to set the stage again for a look at the dissonances in this patriarchal family as we find it portrayed in Genesis. Well, first of all, it's fairly obvious that we cannot in good conscience take the families of the patriarchs as models for our own times. Hagar was not Abram's slave girl. She was Sarai's. And she was so completely Sarai's personal property that Sarai could simply give her to her husband and then have her and her son exiled into the desert to die. Isaac seems to have been totally ineffectual. It's hard to come up with any. Do you remember anything that Isaac did? You remember what was done to him. He was almost sacrificed by his father. But awfully hard to remember anything that Isaac did.
Well,
he dug some wells. Yes. Yes. Good. Whoopee. He went down to Philistia, and yes, and he dug some wells. That's about the only thing that says that Isaac did.
Important in that
way. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. But. We'll come back to Isaac shortly. Jacob, of course, was a polygamist. He had two wives, and he had six sons by one, and two by another, and two by each by slave girls of his two wives. We have laws against that sort of thing. This is a biblical model that is not to be recommended. Well, the basic principles of patriarchy are quite simple. The father is the absolute ruler of the family, entitled to, in this era, to as many wives as he may choose. Wives are little more than personal property. On the death of the father, the eldest son inherits the birthright. The younger sons basically are left to fend for themselves, find their own fortunes. So much for the theory. In the events themselves, the wives play a much larger role than the theory grants them. Abram is not succeeded by his firstborn son, he's succeeded by Sarah's firstborn son. Not by Ishmael, but by Isaac. And in fact, Hagar and Ishmael, his firstborn son, are exiled from the family at Sarah's insistence. In the next generation, the discrepancy is, if anything, more explicit. Esau, the elder twin, is clearly Isaac's favorite, but Jacob is Rebekah's. Jacob outwits his brother for the birthright. Rebekah outwits Isaac in the matter of the paternal blessing. This is where Isaac comes back into the story again, largely as someone to whom something is done, not someone who gets something done. So the traditional sequence of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is essentially a fiction. And the true, quote, patriarchal line, the line of the people who made the decisions, is much more like Sarah, Rebecca, and Jacob. Well, when we come to the 12 sons of Jacob, the question of birthright never becomes explicit. Jacob's firstborn son, Reuben, does seem to have a leadership role among the brothers, but Joseph's rise to prominence occurs completely outside the boundaries of the family. Nothing is made explicitly of the fact that he is the firstborn son of Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel. He's described as Jacob's favorite because he was the son of his old age. But this position has two major consequences. First, his father's favoritism triggers the fraternal envy that consigns him to Egyptian slavery. And second, this results in his being the unquestioned dominant figure in his generation. So if there's one lesson to be learned from the literal sense of the stories of the patriarchal period, it would seem to be that families never follow the rules. It's all very well to see flaws in the system, and certainly our human design systems are just as flawed as the individuals who design them. But we cannot assume that any individual or any family exactly mirrors that system. All will be affected by it. Some may flout it on the surface and follow it internally. Some may follow it on the surface and flout it internally. There'll be all kinds of gradations and shadings of compliance and rebellion. When we turn to the matter of spiritual meaning and try to see these stories in the context of the larger narrative, it's not difficult, I think, to see the shape of a human life reflected in the shape of the literal story, starting with a very small beginning, awakening to the promise of independent adulthood, reaching that apparent independence, discovering its weaknesses, it is not all it was promised to be, and to being pressed with ever-increasing insistence to focus on our eternal welfare rather than on any form of material success, on the kingdom of heaven rather than the kingdom of Israel. And to digress just a moment, the kingdom of heaven is not just life after death. It is human heaven in the Swedenborgian view is essentially human community. So this means an increasing focus on our relationships with other human beings as we grow older, rather than on our prestige or our possessions. So in this context, the Genesis stories reflect early childhood, both in position and, I think, in substance. They're small-scale stories, for one thing. They're stories not about nations, but about families, about fathers and mothers and children. They can be properly characterized as episodic. Especially in the early chapters, there's very little sense of continuity of connection, for example, between the stories of Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah and the stories about Ishmael and Isaac, and yet they're sort of interwoven as you read. It's only as we get into Jacob's generation that we find a kind of plot that's sustained with some consistency, and this, I'd suggest, is very much like childhood. When in the earlier years, yesterday is gone when it's gone, and tomorrow is not very real to us, at best a passing notion. And the patterns that I mentioned seem particularly appropriate. While we address our children through their minds, there is a protracted period in which, in the language of object relations theory, about which I'll be saying more shortly, they are their impulses. And it takes time before children can step outside their impulses and evaluate them, before impulses are something that they have rather than something that they are. In the language of correspondence, I think this is quite tellingly represented by the controlling roles of both Sarah and Rebecca as representing the predominance of affection over intellect, and the lessened importance then of Leah and Rachel as the story proceeds. And then there's this matter of the firstborn. And quite simply, the discrepancy between theory and actuality in this regard strikes me as thoroughly appropriate image of the fact that the first ventures of a child into any really new territory are not likely to succeed. The second try is much more promising because the child has discovered limitations, learned from the first, tried it, it didn't work, back to the drawing board. Incidentally, I can't resist saying I was informed some time ago or prompted to think that, you know, whoever invented the drawing board must have gotten it right the first time. It's the matter of prospering outside the promised land, though, that for me holds the most interest. I'm particularly fond of a book by a developmental psychologist, I better slow down a little closer to 33 here, named Robert Keegan, which sees the human process through the lens of object relations theory. Its major premise is that our psychological growth is fueled by a necessary tension between two very legitimate needs, a need for autonomy and a need for belonging. And that the healthy growth process proceeds in a kind of spiral. We begin completely embedded. Bit by bit, we discover our separateness, so to speak. But at each step, we also discover that separateness itself is terribly lonely. So we return to community because life has no meaning apart from our relationships, and then discover that we can't enter fully into relationships if our sense of identity is not discovered and nourished. So there is in our own lives a recurrent pattern of famine in the land, venturing out, enriching our sense of who we are, and bringing that richer and more complete person back into the nurturing community. And this has very clear implications for that nurturing community, which in the case of early childhood especially is the family. And I'd like to quote Keegan at this point. Evolutionarily, there is a sense in which the infant and the person throughout life climbs out of a psychological amniotic environment, a psychological womb. Some part of that world in which the infant is embedded nourishes his gestation and assists in delivering him to a new evolutionary balance. I call that part the embeddedness culture, that most intimate of contexts out of which we repeatedly are recreated. I suggest that it, that is this nurturing environment, serves at least three functions. It must hold on, it must let go, and it must stick around so that it can be reintegrated. Love the way he goes from all the big words down to some very, very simple ones. That's the close of the quote. It's not at all hard, I think, to see how precisely these three functions answer to the tension just mentioned, the tension between our need for autonomy and our need for belonging. Because of our need for belonging, the family has to be willing and able to hold us when we need to be held. Because of our need for autonomy, family has to be able to let go of us when our need is for independence. And because our need for independence does not negate our need for belonging, the family has to be there for us to come back to. So with this in mind, let's look a little more closely at the patriarchal family, the Genesis story. That is, in a sense, nourishment and famine are both characteristic of the family. The family does nurture the child, but outside the family is a vastly greater and in some sense a vastly richer world. And the time comes then when a child is more aware of the limitations of the family than of the nurture, when the child feels spiritually or mentally starved and has a hunger, even a passion, for finding out what's out there. And bit by bit, the child ventures further out into the world and stays outside longer. I'm reminded that my older sister Gertrude was the adventurous one as a child, and she wound up, when she played outdoors, literally on a leash, because her instinct was to head straight down Elm Street from the parsonage in Freiburg, straight down toward the railroad station. Each time, though, if all goes well, the child returns enriched by what has been experienced and learned, capable of both giving and receiving more within the family. And I find this pattern beautifully pictured in the succession of patriarchs. The story of Abram's time in Egypt is very brief. All it amounts to is that one story about his attempt to pass his wife off as his sister, and then it says he got rich and came back. His son Isaac's stay in Philistine country seems to be considerably more extensive. There's a virtual repetition of the wife and sister episode, but it does say that he sowed crops, reaped a harvest, and dug wells, and only then moved back. And it sounds as though it was a time of some years. And when we come to the story of Jacob, we find him leaving home because, of course, his fear of Esau, serving his uncle Laban 7 years for a wife who turned out to be Leah, another 7 years for Rachel, and apparently, this brief mention, another 7 years after that. So, see, these excursions outside the family, outside the Holy Land, are getting longer and longer. And then, of course, the settlement in the land of Goshen was a matter of at least a generation or more. But there is no question that the promised land is home. That's made clear at the outset, for as soon as Abram arrives at Shechem, the Lord appears to him and tells him, "This is the land that will be given to his descendants." So let me take a little time taking a closer look at the land. I've been treating it as a symbol of the home and even of the family, but a more rigorous application of principles of correspondence would see it as our inner sense of who we are. But this is inseparable for our sense of where we belong, our home, because the whole process of judgment we face after death is a matter of finding home, finding the community that supports our own values. And over our lifetime in this world, this home will change as we ourselves change. And there are two ways of describing the relationship between our identity and our community. One is to say that we define ourselves by the community we choose, and the other is to say that the community we choose defines who we are. We might, in fact, say that our identity at all times is a matter of location. And when we turn to the geography of the Bible, to the physical terrain that corresponds to our spiritual selves and their environment, it turns out that the Holy Land is a matter of location too. It's not remarkable for its size, its resources, its fertility, but unique in its location, as I mentioned last night, because it's the only land on earth where three continents meet: Africa, Asia, and Europe. And in biblical times, when travel routes were determined by the terrain and by the available of food and water, it was little more than a bridge between the vastly larger empires, richer lands of Mesopotamia and Egypt. So it was a kind of geopolitical point of tension that could scarcely avoid being a point of conflict. And Isaiah's vision of Israel as a blessing between Assyria and Egypt is little short of astonishing. How could the man have come up with this idea in those times if it had not been for some kind of message from God? On that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. The Assyrian will come into Egypt and the Egyptian into Assyria. The Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. And on that day, Israel will be a third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my heritage. Well, there is a sense in which each of us individually feels like the center of everything, for the simple reason that we experience everything as being around us. And there's a similar sense of the family as the center in a much larger world. And families will from time to time be invaded by values that are contrary to their own. Children go off to school, find themselves dealing with others whose notions of what is normal are quite different, who take different things for granted. And more as the years pass, the child will be living in that kind of world, the kind of outside world. And parents who are appropriately concerned to help their children become socially constructive and effective adults have to start early. Well, I'd close by calling attention to one of the most obvious features of the patriarchal family as we find it in Genesis, and that is that it grows. It does indeed grow. At first, there are only Abraham and Sarah, then only Isaac and Rebekah, but then we have Jacob with both Leah and Rachel, and in the next generation, 12 sons. And I find this a wholly appropriate image of the way in which we become more complex as we grow. We see the world and ourselves in increasing detail. We become capable of dealing with increasingly complex situations. We grow, that is, by internalizing the complexity of the world around us. This is Ilya Prigozhin's insight, which I think is immensely valuable, which again reflects the intimate relationship between the world within us and the world outside. And it occurs to me belatedly also the fact that we start with generalizations, which then become the lodging places for details. And by the same token, the family will become more complex as the children mature. The demands on the parents of a newborn baby are immense, but they're relatively straightforward. The demands of the parents of teens may be far less constant because teens can take care of themselves in many respects, but they're far, far more complex and more subtle. Parenting is a highly educational experience, provided we're willing to learn. That's where the manuscript stops, and the floor is yours. And for the sake of the tape, you know, please wait for the mic.
I find it fascinating, though, although the line rarely follows the firstborn theory, it does apparently always give excuses as to why it doesn't. And yeah. In the case of Jacob's sons, it's not the first, it's not the second, it's not the third, it's the fourth, Judah, who becomes the dominant son. Mm-hmm. Reuben is weak like water, and he goes into his father's bed, mm-hmm. meaning he sleeps with one of his father's wives. Simeon and Levi, as I recall, hauled off and killed a bunch of people that they shouldn't have, mm-hmm. and so they weren't going to be a suitable heir, but Judah is mm-hmm. the one who takes the lead. And you see this taking place particularly in the story of the brothers going down to Israel, where it's not Reuben, Simeon, or Levi who is the one who attempts to save Benjamin, but rather Judah, who well, not only attempts to save him, but is the one who convinces the father to let them take him in the first place down to Egypt, and then offers to stand in for him and brings the whole story to its conclusion, where Joseph finally reveals himself. Mm-hmm. And so I find it fascinating that although it doesn't follow, there is some logic to it, Judah being a very strong character who had taken the leadership role, and the others who had essentially abdicated their role in one way or another, right on down the line. And it's really the same with Esau and Jacob, where Esau abdicates his role.
Yeah.
Another thing I find fascinating is that the dominant from each of the wives, each of the primary wives, end out being the northern and southern kingdoms, with Ephraim being a synonym for Israel, the northern kingdom, and Judah becoming the name of the southern. And you find even when a dominant has been established, they still fight among themselves to see who's going to be the dominant.
Yeah.
It's not a question, it's an observation, I guess.
Yeah. And you have a very similar kind of need to find excuses in the story of the divided kingdom, where from time to time, let's say he was a wonderful king, but the nation ran into all kinds of trouble because his grandfather had been so terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a terrible king, but God felt so sorry for them because they were had so in such deep trouble, and he remembered David, so he was very good to them.
Yeah.
It's always we can rationalize almost anything. There's a way.
I wanted to put a word in for Reuben. If it wasn't for Reuben saying, don't kill him, let's put him in a pit. As an older brother, he really took a leadership role in the right thing and said, let's not kill him. He intended, as I read it, to get him out later so he could go back to his dad. So and Joseph wouldn't have been saving his people and all kinds of other things. So I'm putting a word in for Reuben.
Lee's back there.
Reuben really tried to be the dominant, but it was Judah that the brothers listened to. It's true that Reuben tried to save his brother, but he was ineffectual in doing that. If he had really been a leading character, the brothers would have listened to him, and they wouldn't have done it in the first place. His effort was to save him behind the brother's back, and he was intending to go back to the pit and get him. But there was one consequence of that, which I find fascinating, and that is when the brothers are sent back to get Benjamin, supposedly to test whether they're really being honest with Joseph, Joseph picks one of the brothers to be bound. And you would think that he would bind the oldest, the leading one, but he didn't. He bound Simeon, who was the second, and because he knew that Reuben was trying to save him. So he passed over the eldest and went to the next Simeon and had him bound and taken. And I find that a fascinating little detail in that story.
Mm-hmm. Virginia Satir would have a wonderful time with the family dynamic.
George, I'm thinking about your illustration that the land of milk and honey,
mm-hmm.
But they established themselves outside of that land of milk and honey. Isn't that true with our families? Although you and I may try to do the best for our children in our home, it seems like they find themselves outside. And we may say something to them and they don't hear it, but someone outside says the same thing. They hear it as if they're hearing it for the first time.
Yeah.
And I didn't know whether that would fit in with the idea of what you were trying to get across there.
Yeah. And your kids go and stay with somebody else, and you're a little worried as to how they got along, and they come back, and the people that are taking care of them say, you have the greatest kids, they were so helpful around the house, and you say, what?
No, it's typical.
Yeah. Well, it is an immensely richer world outside the family. There's a lot more people, a lot more variety. They run into things they've never heard before. They have to stop and think. They come back with questions that they never had before.
I also think there's a little bit like that here at Freiburg. I think if you've been a young person here at Freiburg, having your parents stay in a cabin, but you're sort of free to be with the young people,
mm-hmm.
and so you can establish your own, but your parents are there. And so in a lot of ways, you're going out, meeting other people, and doing other things, mm-hmm. but your family is sort of there. That's what I experienced here at Freiburg, a wonderful balance between having your parents there and being free.
Yeah. And I'm very fond, I really was struck in that Keegan quote with this trio of being there to hold when the child needs holding, to let go. And of course, there are all kinds of horror stories about parents who couldn't let go of their children, mm-hmm. so on. But also to be there, to come back to. And I think this also could serve as a model for the church, to hold people when they need to be held. We're often a little too good at that. We don't want to let go. And we regard it as a failure when somebody leaves. But that may be what that person needs, and the church mustn't cling so so to speak, and treat the individual as its property and as a membership statistic, to try to understand what are the needs of this individual, and then to be there, to come back to. Randy Lockell told a story at one peer supervision meeting that stayed with me. He had the experience which any number of Swedenborgian ministers have had. Had come and call saying, my grandmother just died, and she was a member of your church years and years ago, and she always wanted to have a Swedenborgian funeral service. And Randy's first reaction, here I've been struggling to help this church grow and so on. Where was this person all my ministry, and what right does she have to call on me now? And then he stops saying, no, it is good that the church is here for her. And it's one of the strengths, I think, of parish ministry is just its durability in a world where there is so much impermanence and so little, to have something that stays around and is there when you need it.
Parallel to that, I had two experiences recently that showed that even if somebody leaves or isn't there anymore, it's never good to assume that they haven't gotten what they needed when they were there. We've had a family that's been gradually coming back to the church in Bridgewater, having left a number of years ago, and one of the ones who was just probably 8 or 10 years old when the family left now has her own children. And she's been coming back from time to time. And at one point she said to me, I had all these things that I believed and thought, and I figured that these were my own ideas. And when I came back here, I realized where I got them.
Yeah.
And the other was at convention, one of the people from the Swedenborgian Church of Puget Sound, who had a son who was in the class that I taught back there when I was in college and interning, getting ready to go to theological school, and I have no idea what I said, but apparently it stuck with him, because here it is over 10 years later, and she's saying, well, my son still remembers many of the things that you said in that class. And I said, oh my gosh, I don't remember what I said, but I'm glad he does.
Yeah. And I could show you pictures of the class that Mother Dole used to conduct out when there was a tree out in the shade out there. And the teenagers sprawled, you would swear they are all sound asleep. And some of them, my contemporaries, will still quote her. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 60 years later.
Mm-hmm. It's actually break time.
Yeah, it is. Thank you for your attention. Mm-hmm.